We would urge also upon the people of our convention fellowship and all Christian citizens the following. First, that we commend the President, the Secretary of State, and other leaders in both parties for their public utterances and patient diplomatic conduct, which indicate their purpose to exhaust every possible means toward peace without war. Second, that we endeavor to put out of our thought and speech such ideas as that war is inevitable, that war is the only way to stabilize international relations, that the sooner we go to war and get it over with, the better, or that to seek peace avidly is to display either weakness or hypocrisy. The Christians of America must become the promoters of peace. Third, that we reaffirm our loyal faith in God, our faith in God the Father as the God of peace, our faith in God the Son as the Prince of Peace, who came to establish peace with the Father and among men of goodwill, our faith in God the Holy Spirit, whose mission from within the hearts of his people is to break down dividing walls of pride and bitterness and create a new humanity in Christ. The Christians of America are called upon to become the active instruments of God by living and walking in the Spirit of God. Fourth, that we give ourselves to prayer for peace in private and in our churches, that we set peace in the center of our heart's desire for mankind because we love the Lord and cannot forget or limit the meaning of his words, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." Mr. President, I move the adoption of this recommendation.
You've heard the motion and seconded for the adoption of this resolution. Time, of course, is permitted for those and requested and desired for those who would speak from the floor as well as those who would speak to it. You'll bear that in mind, Brother Weatherspoon, I'm sure.
I do not desire to make an address as the program suggested. A professor who is accustomed to 50 minutes for a lecture can't even undertake a 5-minute address. I do want to say this. We believe that the Southern Baptist Convention could not afford to go through its annual meeting without expressing itself in favor of all the efforts that are being made to establish world peace. And I'm not thinking, my brethren, of saving America. I'm thinking of keeping the doors open around the world for the gospel of Jesus Christ. We know what war has done. And if the military and scientific people are right, we know that the disaster of another war could not at all be measured or imagined as we face it today. We are conscious that this resolution does not go as far as some of our idealists would want us to go. We are also conscious that some of those who are close to the military and to the stark realities of international hate will not feel that we have gone far enough in some other matters, and also that perhaps we should not have asked this convention to go on record concerning universal military training. However, we felt bold in this because of one or two things. One, that on two occasions you have already adopted practically unanimously the same resolution brought to you by the Social Service Commission, as it was then, and now the Christian Life Commission. We are also encouraged to add our word to those forces in Congress and in the places of leadership in our nation who have expressed themselves so thoroughly that now the matter of adopting immediately or trying to adopt a universal military training clause has been left out of the legislation proposed. It has not been abandoned altogether, but we feel that in common with all the great religious denominations of America, that however individual Baptists may feel about this matter, as a great convention holding on as far as we can to the high ideals of Jesus Christ and for maintaining a nation without the stamp of militarism and without the loss of more freedom of our people, that this resolution ought to be passed. And I believe that in your hearts, you mothers and fathers, with your prayer for peace, will find it in your hearts not only to vote heartily for this recommendation, but to go back to our churches to pray and to speak in behalf of that peace which will give to us not only comfort ourselves, but an open opportunity for the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ.
Brother Weatherspoon, just a moment, please, sir. Brother Weatherspoon, for the purposes of clarification, it is headed here a resolution, is it not?
No,
really?
No, that's a recommendation.
Yes, sir.
In our report,
yes,
it is a recommendation.
In your bulletin of yesterday, under Christian Life Commission report, it is headed a resolution. It should have been a recommendation, and that's what it is. Okay. Anyone wish to speak to the matter from the floor or anywhere?
Mr. President.
Judge Hooper.
I certainly hesitate to take the floor again. I'm afraid I'll be denominated here the great referrer to committees. But I want to say that this resolution contains two matters of tremendous importance. And I want to say that if we adopt the resolution as read, we are asking our national government to reverse all of its policies built up through recent years by both the Democratic and Republican parties. We are asking them to discard well thought out plans which were made by such good gentlemen, statesmen, and Baptists as Senator Kerr of Oklahoma, Senator Walter F. George of Georgia, and other very distinguished statesmen and senators and congressmen who have been close to the international situation and have studied the matter of our national security for years and years and years. Now, for one thing, the resolution, if I interpret it correctly, says that we are opposed to any atomic weapons. I would hate to see this convention say that we were opposed to atomic weapons. If we are to have a war, if we are attacked, and if there's going to be a war, there's not but one way to fight a war.
Judge Hooper?
Yes, sir.
If you will pardon, please. Brother Weatherspoon has a personal privilege.
I would like for him to reread those two portions, Dr. Weatherspoon, very much, sir.
Let me say there's nothing said about opposition. That word does not occur. Fifth, that we urge immediate and more determined efforts to reach effective agreements for the elimination of atomic weapons, including the hydrogen bomb, and for the radical reduction of armaments as a means of increasing the probabilities of peaceful existence. If I read my papers correctly, that's exactly what our President and Secretary of State are now trying to do.
Well,
they are speaking openly of disarmament. They are trying to get Russia to agree to a disarmament conference that would be effective. They are working, and we are only asking that they keep on. There's no opposition to national policy.
Well,
except
sir,
it should be a policy of war.
Judge Hooper?
I do not object to the resolution as reread. I first interpreted it as an effort to abolish atomic weapons. Now, I would like to ask if Dr. Weatherspoon would read the other portion about compulsory military training.
About what?
Military training, university.
Oh. This is a repetition of the action that has been taken on two former occasions by this convention. Although it is not a copy of the action taken by any religious body that we know anything about, we recognize the necessity of adequate preparation for national defense. We deplore any effort of the military to establish a continuing policy of universal requirement of military service. Perhaps the word peacetime should have been there, but that's what it means. Believing that the selective service law, now in action, is sufficient, and that the fruits of military training would further weaken the principle of freedom. We are already realizing that as citizens, 1 inch by 1 inch is being taken away from the freedom of parents and their children, the freedom of individuals, and we believe, if history is correct and the records of other nations, that universal military training would further endanger the principle of individual liberty that has been so precious to America. And we believe that it would increase the danger of our becoming a military civilization tempted to world domination. What nations have attempted world domination except those that had universal military training? And in the wars, the two or three wars through which I have lived, not the Civil War, it happens that the people, the nations that had universal military training did not win the war. And we are afraid for us as Christians, as Baptists, to vote for us to become so thoroughly militarized when other means are adequate, especially in this new day of warfare mechanical.
Judge Hooper. Judge Hooper.
Mr. President.
Yes, sir.
We are all very much in favor of having as little military training as necessary. However, to sustain our national existence and our national life, which has been threatened through several great world wars, we must have a group of young men who are trained so that in the event of a war, and we have never started an aggressive war, but so that we might protect ourselves and might protect little helpless, God-fearing, love-fearing nations who might be run over and crushed and destroyed as we have seen in two world wars. And as I take it, brethren, we must do one of two things. We must either have a large standing army, which is bankrupt and disastrous, or we must have a group of our young men trained and in readiness in the event that there should be a war, that we can call out an army. Now, the question of peacetime draft and selective service, I admit, are very closely intertwined, and in a lot of people's minds, they do not get the difference. I think, though, that the resolution should be so clearly worded as not to carry the implication that we are opposed to the training of our young men. And as having had three sons who have been or will be trained that way, I, for one, am very much in favor of our young men being trained and not thrown into a war without sufficient training.
The time has come and is past now for this order of the day. Whatever clarification there ought to be, of course, must be, but we shall have to vote on it. It is not a resolution. It is a recommendation.
Brother Chairman, may we make a statement of one sentence? And that is, this is Wynn of Georgia speaking, and that statement is that we hope we may never come to the time that the Southern Baptist Convention will ever become squeamish about telling what it stands for and what it recommends, regardless of whoever or from wherever they may come or official position they occupy may think to the contrary.
Thank you, sir. I didn't know anybody could have a longer sentence than I could make, but you have. You're ready for the question. Time is long since gone. We no time for debates on this now. Those in favor of the recommendation will please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed will please say no. The ayes have it. Yes, you do. The reports are brought to you now, the recommendation as a whole. Those in favor of adopting it as a whole will please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. And so the recommendations and report adopted as a whole. Other witness.
Mr. Chairman, I bring you the report of the Committee on Committees, and I make this report for Dr. Grant, who had to take a plane just a few moments ago and asked me to make it for him. This is the report of the Committee to Study Theological, Religious, and Missionary Education that you referred to your committee yesterday. Dr. J.W. Storer, Oklahoma, Chairman. J.S. Bell, Kentucky. Carl Clark, Texas. Thomas E. Chappell, Florida. Forrest Feaser, Texas. Garland Hendricks, North Carolina. Herschel Hobbs, Oklahoma. Douglas Hutchins, Mississippi. J.W. Lester, Alabama. Mrs. George R. Martin, Virginia. Louis Newton, Georgia. E.V. Payton, Virginia. I move its adoption, Mr. Chairman.
Motion is made and seconded that it be adopted. Any questions about it? Those in favor will please say aye. Contrary-minded, no. And it is carried. Brother Westmoreland.
With the consent of the President and the Chairman of the Committee on Order of Business, we would like to bring at this time the report of the Committee on Time, Place, and Preacher, which is scheduled for in the morning. We would like to present the report with the understanding that if it calls for discussion, that it be referred to the Committee on Order of Business to set a time, a future time, for the discussion. I should like to say, as Chairman of the Committee, we had three invitations for a meeting place for 1958. We had the invitation from Fort Worth, Texas, from Denver, Colorado, and from Houston, Texas. The Committee was thoroughly in sympathy with the desire of the brethren from Fort Worth that we hold our convention there in 1958 due to the fact that Southwestern Seminary will be observing its 50th anniversary at that time. However, in studying the invitation, the date they suggested was June the 8th through the 12th. The rooms committed by Fort Worth Hotels in cooperation with Dallas Hotels, 2,500 rooms. In the light of the requirements of this convention on account of its size, we did not feel that we would be justified in recommending, as much as our hearts told us we wanted to go to Fort Worth, our heads told us we should not try to cramp this convention into such limited facilities. The date is late. The Coliseum is not air-conditioned, and in the middle of June, it would be terrifically warm in Fort Worth. I say that because, as Chairman of the Committee, I am embarrassed to say that our committee voted to recommend the place for the 1958 convention, Houston, Texas. May I say that our facilities there have been thoroughly air-conditioned since you were there. You will not recognize the Coliseum. It has been thoroughly air-conditioned. It has been enclosed. It has been relighted. You even have escalators to the balcony. You'll find it a very delightful place in which to meet. The time, May the 20th through the 23rd, 1958. We would further recommend, in connection with the date, that the convention open on Tuesday evening, May the 20th, and that the Committee on Order of Business of the Southern Baptist Convention for that year, that's the year 1958, and the Program Committee of the Southern WMU jointly arranged the program for Tuesday evening. That makes the dates Tuesday evening through Friday evening, with the convention closing on Friday night. The preacher for the annual sermon next year, 1956 at Kansas City, we recommend Harry P. Stagg of Albuquerque, New Mexico. As alternate, James M. Baldwin, Salem, Illinois. Signed by the members of the committee. Brother President, I recommend the adoption of the report.
Motion is made and seconded. Are there any questions or remarks about it? Those in favor will please say aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. It is so carried. Brother McCall.
May I make a motion, sir? This committee has a very difficult job. It is appointed here at this convention. It has to act on these matters before there is any. It cannot itself visit these places. And I'm going to ask that we change our convention procedure in this regard by making a motion that this committee be continued as the committee on time and place until its successor committee is named and qualified, which would be at the convention in Kansas City. That would mean that this same committee would be able to go and to check the invitations that are going to be given during the year that is ahead to visit the sites, to see the facilities, and to ascertain whether the invitation actually can be accepted or not. Mr. Chairman, if I can get a second to the motion, I will move. Though I had not planned it at this time, I thought this whole thing was coming tomorrow. I wanted to talk to some people about the motion, but I hereby move that this committee be continued until its successor committee is named and qualified, and that it can do the work that is necessary from now until we meet together in Kansas City with reference to the time and place of the next annual meeting to be considered there.
Recognized.
I just wanted to call attention to the bylaws of the convention, which state that the executive committee is instructed by the convention to have oversight of the arrangements for the meetings of the convention, with authority to change both the time and place of the meetings in accordance with the provisions of Article 11, Section 3 of the Constitution. The executive committee has a committee on convention arrangements, which is charged with this responsibility. And my only concern is not to whom this should be delegated, but that there be no overlapping of responsibilities in that area. And I'm wondering if some consideration perhaps should not be given at that point, Dr. McCall.
Mr. President, Dr. Ruth, this was what I wanted to talk to you about before making this motion. Actually, there is, in my judgment, no overlapping. For the responsibility of the Convention Arrangement Committee, of the Executive Committee, is to provide for the arrangements after the Committee on Time, Place, and Preacher, which is a convention committee, makes its report and the convention acts. That is to say, after the convention acts, then the Committee on Time, the subcommittee of the executive committee on arrangements goes into action. And so I am trying to keep alive the conventions committee, and you surely will understand that I gain nothing by doing this, other than the fact that this committee, which is going to do its planning, will not be depending on reports handed to it, but on personal visits and personal investigation, which they cannot do if they're not appointed until 24 or 36 hours before they have to bring their report.
Brother Ruth?
Brother President? May I?
Well, go ahead.
May I ask Dr. McCall if there's any reason why it wouldn't be better to have this convention appoint the new committee and let them function so that when they come next year, they wouldn't have to change horses at that time. Is there any reason why we couldn't do that, Dr. McCall? I think it's a good idea.
Well, I do not have any objection at all to the personnel of the committee, except that if you're going to have a convention committee on time, place, and preacher, it seems to me that that convention committee ought to be in a position to make its investigation before it has to report.
Brother Chairman.
The chair would like to just be indulged in this, brethren. You have, in the morning at 9:40, we have miscellaneous business. Why couldn't you bring all this up then?
We ask this question, Brother Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Isn't it true that this convention cannot appoint legally any committee to serve in the next convention, which is not yet in session?
I didn't quite get your question, my friend. I think the idea was that couldn't this convention do anything it wanted to legally? It can do anything it wants to legally.
No, sir. This question is this.
Well, I say, if it's legal, it can be done.
Well, the question was, would it be legal for us to appoint a committee that is due to be appointed by the next convention, which is not yet in session?
Thank you, sir, for your clarification.
Mr. President, in order to give us a little more time, I move you, sir, that this matter be tabled until there has been time for further conference and that it then be brought back under the advice of the Committee on Order of Business to this convention for action either later today or tomorrow.
Any objection to unanimous consent that that be done? It will be done.
Brother President, at your request, I am announcing the following committee which you have appointed on the Barton Resolution. Dr. Baker James Cawthon, Judge Frank A. Hooper, Dr. Duke McCall, Dr. C.C. Warren, and Mr. Barry Garrett. And the chairman has the list and a copy of the resolution.
There is an emergency message for Lieutenant Robert Lindsay at the information counter. The Radio and Television Commission will have a luncheon meeting today at 2 p.m. in the Bayview Room of the McAllister Hotel. I hold in my hand a telegram received by President Storer from T.B. McNorman for the Baptist Federation of Canada. The President asks that I read it to you. Canadian Baptists extend warmest greetings to Southern Baptist Convention gathered at Miami. May richest blessings attend your deliberations and result from all decisions made. Mr. President, I move that the Secretary be instructed to reply to this message.
Motion is made and seconded. Those in favor will please say aye. Contrary, no, and it is so ordered. We now come to the time of the seminaries, and I think, Brother Heron, you...
Let's all stand and sing one stanza of our theme song, Glory to His Name. Time, the faculty male quartet of Southern Seminary will only sing one number. It's a number that I've enjoyed singing. It's a ballad gospel song, Sing Me a Song of Sharon's Rose.
Very beautiful and very lovely indeed. We come now to the report of the seminaries. I do not know who has that. Duke, do you have it? Brother McCall, do you have that in charge?
Dr. Storer, I like that first introduction. You know, I'm not particularly nervous about standing behind this desk or this microphone, for 13 years it has been my privilege to serve Southern Baptist in the seminary in New Orleans, and then to try to be a forerunner for, I think, the finest executive secretary this convention not only has had but will ever have, Dr. Porter Ruth. But I confess to you that I am always awed when I try to stand before the Southern Baptist Convention to represent Southern Seminary, following in the footsteps of Boyce and Broadus and Whitsitt and Mullins and Sampey and Fuller. Those names conjure up visions of men who have been statesmen with wisdom beyond human wisdom as they have found the Spirit of God their guide and stay. To come and try to speak now in that succession, to come and try to represent the trustees of Southern Seminary, 55 of them scattered across the length and breadth of our convention territory, to come and try to represent the faculty of the seminary, and I would that I knew how to tell you how proud I am of the faculty of Southern Seminary. Of the 62 members of the faculty of the seminary who have ever signed the Articles of Faith, whereby we pledge ourselves to walk down the middle of the road of our Baptist convictions as enunciated in 1858 in the Articles written by Manley. I find myself somehow or other wondering how can I do it and what can I say, as I come to you to represent the 1,629 students on the campus of Southern Seminary. Every year, more students. We thought, I was on the other side of the fence when our great Southeastern Seminary was founded. One reason was that it should share the load of students with Southern Seminary. Yet now we find that with the tremendous growth of Southeastern, Southern Seminary continues to grow at the rate of 100 net gain of students year after year. And so it goes. I wish that I could tell you something about this institution. We do want you to come to Louisville in 1959 at our centennial, if it can be. We do not want you to come unless you will be adequately provided for that would help neither us nor you. But we want you to come because we know that if you come close to this institution, the more you can know about us, the better you will, I started to say, love them. And I know you will have the respect for these men who are dedicated to the truth as revealed by God. But now I want to present one of those men to you. Since 1920, Gaines S. Dobbins has been a member of the faculty of Southern Seminary. 35 years in office as a faculty member. Since 1953, Dean of the School of Religious Education of Southern Seminary. Approaching a year from now, retirement. Do you think we're going to let him retire? Not Baptist. As long as Gaines S. Dobbins continues to think and teach as he does think and teach. But we've been thinking about his successor to come and take over the administration of the School of Religious Education. And we are providing a year of overlapping of the dean-elect with Dean Dobbins. And I want Dean Gaines S. Dobbins to come and present the man elected yesterday afternoon unanimously and enthusiastically by the Board of Trustees of Southern Seminary as dean-elect of the School of Religious Education of the seminary, Dean Dobbins.
Thank you, President McCall. After all these years of teaching, many of them burdened with the dual responsibility of administration, I've requested the administrative officers and the trustees to relieve me of administrative duties in order that I may give these last years wholly to teaching. Southern Seminary, as you know, has come to be a great theological university. At the center is the School of Theology. About that center are gathered two other schools, the School of Church Music, the School of Religious Education. Each of these, of course, must have a dean. Someone has facetiously said that a dean is a man who isn't quite smart enough to be a professor, but who is too smart to be president. We've been looking for a dean to take over responsibility for this youngest school of your seminary, said the stripling to the sage. What is your aim in your old age? Said the sage, a trifle tired. I have no aim. I've already fired. But I do have an aim. It is just as vivid as it was in 1920 when I came to the seminary. And that is that the seminary shall render maximum service to the denomination to which it owes everything and to the kingdom of God around the world. And so when we began to look for a man to assume this very heavy responsibility, both as teacher and as guide of teachers, as guide of students, as administrator, as teammate to the president, to the other deans. We thought and prayed and searched until the spotlight came on a man whom we hardly dared believe we could get. And yet the Lord works at the other end of the line when you pray. And so it is that he has given his consent to become the dean-elect and to give me the privilege of sitting beside him during the next year, sharing with him any experience which I may, and then turning over to him this tremendous responsibility for the ongoing of this great school of religious education. Dr. Alan W. Graves was born in Arkansas. His family removed when he was a child to southern Illinois. There he received his education. He achieved the degree of Bachelor of Education at University of Southern Illinois. He then came to our seminary, where he achieved our highest degree, Doctor of Theology. He has had a distinguished career as pastor, as preacher, as teacher. It therefore gives me great personal pleasure to introduce to you the dean-elect of the School of Education of Southern Seminary. And I think it would be quite befitting for his distinguished brother, Dr. Harold K. Graves, president of Golden Gate Seminary, to escort him to the platform and introduce him. Dr. Graves.
I'm happy to present my little brother, Alan.
This is getting to be a habit in Miami. 3 years ago, you laid upon my brother the same kind of a decision that you're laying upon me here today. I want to ask that you join with me in praying that there might be the clear and definite guidance in the decision that will be made about it. I have some very firm convictions. I believe in a church-centered, pastor-led, denominationally anchored church program. Amen. I believe that the members of a church staff are on a team and that they all ought to be on the same team. I believe that as a pastor, I have a tremendous responsibility in reaching the total membership of the church and the people round about the church. To that task, I've given myself with a joy and abandon that I have tremendously appreciated. And now I trust that you will pray for me as this responsibility is laid upon me to share with others that which I have sought to do for the Lord.
Thank you, Mr. President, and our report has no recommendations and is laid in your hands.
Thank you, Brother McCall. There is no recommendations, therefore we shall, I think, nothing to adopt. The next speaker who speaks for our seminary at New Orleans is the dean, I believe I've heard someone say, of all the deans of the Southern Baptist Convention, Brother Roland Levin.
Mr. President, the Apostle Paul exhorts us to strive to become a full-grown man. That can be applied to an individual, that can be applied to a church, and that certainly can be applied to a theological seminary. This habit of electing people to the seminary tasks is older than 3 years. For it happened with me here in Miami 9 years ago. Since I was asked to assume the responsibilities of my position at New Orleans, we have been trying to build that seminary in every way like a full-grown man. A full-grown man must have a body. He must have a mind or a head. He must have eyes and hands and heart and all of that. We have tried to build a seminary along these lines. The body of a seminary might be compared to the physical plant and the support of the institution. The physical plant might be like the flesh, and the financial support of the institution might be compared to the blood of a body. We are very grateful to God and to all of you that our physical plant at New Orleans is rapidly growing. We this week entered for the first time the new J.M. Frost building for the School of Religious Education. There we have a summer school going on this week with about 200 students already enrolled. This completes the program of three buildings, one for our School of Theology, one for our School of Sacred Music, and now for the School of Religious Education. We are grateful for this physical equipment which we have. This last month, we entered 100 new student apartments, making 210 student apartments on our campus. Now the bloodstream of our seminary is the cooperative program, both in the matter of our current support and our capital funds or building program. We are profoundly grateful for what you have done for us, a long way from complete, but far better than anything our institution has ever had before. We are very grateful for the mind or the head directive of our seminary, which I would say is the faculty of our institution. We have had very good fortune in multiplying our faculty by at least three in the last decade, trying to keep pace with the multiplied growth of our student enrollment. We are growing at the rate of nearly 100 per year, which would indicate, according to the standards of the American Association, that our faculty should increase about 5 per year. We have been increasing it by at least 3 every year for the last several years. So we have had good fortune by the grace of God to be able to keep these men who are coming in and watch them develop and grow in a great, effective faculty of consecrated, educated, scholarly Christian men. I rejoice in the fine fellowship that is pure and unalloyed that is prevailing among our faculty at our institution. I rejoice that every one of them is true to the Word of God, to the Baptist tradition, and to all of the responsibilities that are laid upon the people who teach and train our young people. We have these three schools, which I have already mentioned. Of course, the School of Theology is the largest in number, but the other two schools are rapidly growing. Speaking of our religious education school, and I speak for the other seminaries as well, I get about 4 or 5 letters a week asking for educational directors. We are preparing to train more, and I would like to ask you pastors who write to us at our seminaries for trained men to pick out and encourage and lead as far as is humanly right the brighter young men and young women who will dedicate their lives for religious education leadership. Now, I want to emphasize this, if I may, that also we have in our seminary the Department of Christian Training. 9 years ago, here in Miami, the name of our institution was changed to New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. It has never changed in one iota our plan to accept and train non-college students. And let me say that we have more non-college students in our enrollment today than we have ever had in the history of the institution before or after the name was changed. Our student body this year has 206 non-college students who are training for leadership. The degree students who come with a college degree number 688. But now we are training these. 108 of them are preachers, 76 in the field of religious education, and 22 in the field of sacred music who have not had a college education. And I want to repeat that because I've heard it intimated that the Southern Baptist Convention is making no program for our preachers who have not had the privilege of college. We have separate classes, separate curriculum adapted to those who have not had the college privilege, and we count them among the finest and best, sometimes of all of our students. They are equal with the others, and we never intend to cease that department of Christian training. I could speak of the eyes of the seminary with a vision of the world, the hands of the seminary reaching out in mission and evangelistic and soul-winning purpose. The heart of the seminary has alternate heartbeats, faithfulness to the truth of the Bible, and compassion to win lost men at home and abroad to know and love our Lord Jesus Christ.
There are emergency messages at the information desk for W.L. Crumpler and C.M. Clinkshales.
We thank you very, very, very much, Brother Level. The next to speak on for the Southwestern Seminary is Brother Baker. Brother Baker, please.
Mr. President, friends of Southwestern Seminary, I bring you greetings from President J. Howard Williams, 2,375 students in our school, 42 faculty members, and a great host of friends who love Southwestern Seminary. Since Dr. Williams is to bring the principal address in a few moments, he has asked me to say just a word about our school at this time. There are so many facets of life in our school that I hardly know where to begin. Faculty being increased regularly, year by year, facilities for study in our library, additional workers in all departments are making the task grow larger year by year. And in true Texas fashion, I suppose I could go along that line for some time. Let me just share with you the several impressions that come to me from last year's teaching. You know, as teachers, we go through classes year by year. Some have said, don't you get tired teaching the same material year by year? And we answer them that we do not teach the same material year by year. We have new students, and they require new material each time. But I want to share with you in these moments some new things that came last year. One is a great number of new sacrifices. We teach these students New Testament and Old Testament and theology and church history. And as the days come and go, I suppose you get accustomed to the task that's yours. And then we move into chapel, and there we hear a stirring message. And this boy or this girl standing beside you steps out and gives himself and his life and all that he is to the cause of Christ around the world. And somehow all of that monotony and dreariness passes, and you feel again that God has a new sacrifice here. And they move down and say, we're going to the uttermost parts of the world for Christ. Almost one-third of our School of Theology students are missionary volunteers. We have over 410 missionary volunteers on the campus this year. And then in addition to new sacrifices last year, I think one impression that comes is the matter of united witness. We had a number of problems last year in connection with our simultaneous campaigns. There we had all three of the zones to deal with. We couldn't let the students out 1 week and say, now do your preaching, because some students would miss the week that they were supposed to be at school and vice versa. And so we said to each student who was to preach in the campaign, take that week when you are to preach, plus the other time that you have, the 2 weeks for the meeting, and we'll hold school here and let you take any week free that you need. We had some lopsided classes for a day or two, but as we heard the reports of these who had won men and women to Christ and boys and girls across all the sections of Texas and Oklahoma and Arkansas and even as far as New Mexico, we were thrilled to give our time and our attention to such a matter as united witness for Jesus Christ. Now, the other word, you could not visit the seminary, and I'm sorry you can't come. In 58, we're making great plans for our Jubilee meeting. But if you were to come there, you'd be impressed with the fact that each day something new seems to be added. They're now digging holes on each side of our memorial building, on the one side for our library addition, the other side for our theological addition. Last year, this spring, students sat on the steps in the library to study. Every seat in our library has been taken day after day, and they must find places on the campus for their library study. And this new addition, made possible by the cooperative program, has been the answer, and we're looking forward with a great deal of appreciation to entering that new library section. Then our School of Theology has been on every part of our campus. We meet in the basement of the music hall. We meet in every part that makes it possible to have classes. And now we're going to have a new addition to our theology school that makes it possible for us to meet in one building, perhaps, and for our faculty to be together. We at Southwestern, I think, would like to echo what Dr. Level has said. Not only the spirit of comradeship that has certainly been exemplified this year in our seminary, but we feel a comradeship with all of our seminaries. As you read the history of seminary life, seminary education, Southern Baptist life, men like Basil Manley Jr. and Boyce and Broadus and B.H. Carroll, all of these giants of days gone by, perhaps you're impressed as I have been that these men gave a great deal of attention and time to theological education. They felt that here was a place Southern Baptists ought to major. And I believe that in our generation, we're seeing our convention follow the leadership of these great men, as our convention now is providing this wonderful support for our capital needs, as well as the needs of our day-by-day living. We're grateful to you. Come and visit us. If you can't in 1958 on the way to Houston, come before then or after then and see how your seminary is doing.
Now, Brother Staley will come and speak to us on the Southeastern Seminary.
Brethren, you will see our report on page 187 of the Book of Reports. And I shall try to save time that my friend Dr. Williams may have better time and that you yourselves may get out in a comfortable time. Your youngest seminary has continued to grow and strengthen through another year of God's wonderful grace. We opened our doors only 4 years ago, September 1951. We enrolled that fall 76 students. This past school year, we enrolled 394 students and had about that many more applications from those whom we could not receive for lack of space. We now have students from 19 states and two foreign countries. Florida ranks fifth in the number of students enrolled, with a total of 20 men. In the Atlantic Seaboard area, the area which we can most directly serve, are located one-third of all the rural churches in the Southern Baptist Convention. For this reason, we have set up what we feel are exceptional courses in fieldwork and church community development. Special arrangements with the North Carolina State College faculty permit us to give valuable connections and instruction to all those whose work will be in rural and small town communities. We now have religious education courses, and one can take the degree Bachelor of Divinity in Religious Education, or can take the degree Master of Theology in Religious Education. And we do accept women. We will accept more and more, we hope, as we have more space. Many ask about Wake Forest. It is a small town about 15 miles north of Raleigh, North Carolina, and 22 miles east of Durham, North Carolina. Has been the home of Wake Forest College. You've heard of it for that reason, if no other, and for a pretty good football team. I told them last year that probably we would not continue to have a very strong football team, but we thought we could beat the one the college had last year. And if Wake Forest men are here, please don't boo. We paid, that is, the Southern Baptist Convention paid the Wake Forest College authorities $1,600,000 for this campus some several years ago. We have already paid on this purchase price $1,200,000. We owe $400,000 yet, which is to be paid at the very latest by 1961, but which will likely be paid in 1958 or 59 at the very latest. We will gain possession of that college property. Many of you realize that the college is still in Wake Forest, though they are building that marvelous plant in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. They will move next June, they assure us. They are bound by the legal agreement to move by July 1st of 1956. By next June, I mean June 1956. Someone has asked, what all will we do when we get all that campus? Well, there is a good deal there that we will have to remodel and renovate and change and so on. We will have facilities for as many, we hope, as do apply. But what all we'll do with it reminds me of what I heard the other day about Steve Gilstrap of the Christian Science Monitor was down in Mississippi, and he asked a Negro there, what do you want with this racial equality and this desegregation? Well, he says, we just afraid we might get caught up a grassy road with a dull hole, and we don't want to do that. And then he said, well, what are you going to do with it after you get equality with the white folk? He said, I can't tell you that any more than I can tell you how to get back from where I ain't been. We've been so crowded so long that we honestly don't know what we'll do with the space we get, but I can assure you it will be used. And let me say this, it was a real bargain. We will have facilities for 700, 750, almost any number that we can reasonably expect in the next few years, and we will have them for from a one-third to one-half of what it would have cost to go out and erect a new campus somewhere. I consider ourselves in many, many ways very fortunate. I would like to pay a brief tribute to the students and to the faculty we have had. We are not through, my brethren, with the days of heroic self-sacrifice and willingness to put up with many inconveniences in order to serve. Our boys have lived in very, very substandard housing conditions for these last 4 years, and I have not heard a single complaint.
Our faculty have had to invest money that they didn't have in order to build places that they might live at all, except possibly in tents. We have been